Previously on Beta.
Today, we are going to go inside a black hole. It's not going to be comfortable, but it will be pretty fun.
I see dead people walking around like regular people.
I don't see anything.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, so, like it's got...
I'm not trying to be rude here.
It's okay. I agree with you. I totally agree with you.
Oh!
It's artichoke dip, but something went terribly wrong.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, writer Brian Raftery tells us why 1999 was the best movie year ever.
I think Y2K and the new millennium was sort of this sort of subconscious deadline where it's like, that sort of runs through these films and it kind of gives them an electricity and a relevance that I think has kept them in the conversation 20 years later.
And Top Chef fan favorite Kwame Onwuachi talks about the challenges he's faced on the road to becoming a professional chef.
She told me my food was too refined and my skin was too dark. In order to do this type of cuisine, I would need to be white, essentially.
But first, comedian Fred Armisen. The Saturday Night Live and Portlandia star is not only a comedian, he's also a drummer.
Did you feel it? Did you feel it? Did you hear about these baseball guys? Barry Bonds admitted to using steroids. Hey, Barry, next time you get roid rage, do what I do. Use Preparation H.
I do me.
Throughout his career, Fred has combined music with comedy. He melds both passions on his tour, comedy for musicians, but everyone is welcome.
It's more like discussing music. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'll play some music off of my iPad or just stuff that I've found and just talk about it a little bit. And then I go into some of the, you know, quirks about being a guitar player, how we hear guitar, how we hear certain kinds of chords. Mm-hmm. I do a little bit of a history of punk rock.
Yeah, and punk rock drumming in particular, don't you? Can you tell me a bit about that? I'm very intrigued by that.
Well, it's just everything I love. You know,
yeah.
I am always going to be a punk, and I grew up on punk, and being a drummer, it's the road, it's a sort of crossroads of everything that I love. So I just try to filter it down to like a style, like, you know, 1976 punk, 1977 British punk, that kind of thing, going all the way through now. I mean, people have different opinions as to what punk really is.
Mm-hmm.
It's just my version of it.
Yeah.
I kind of include new wave, and I include bands like Tame Impala. I even consider them part of like the scene, whatever that scene is.
Mm-hmm.
Is the progression of what punk rock is.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite punk rock drummer?
Easily. Clem Burke from Blondie. He really was, or is, you know, everything that I love about punk rock drumming.
How so? Can you tell me, like, what is it about
Clem's
style?
It's presentational.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, it's theatrical, but not overly theatrical.
Mm-hmm.
So it has just enough shine and glitter to it, but also very, very 4-4.
Mm-hmm.
4-4 timing, very heavy, very driving, heavy on the toms, lots of fills. Lots of cymbals. It's like driving a bus, but also showing off driving a bus.
Mm-hmm. But not showing off so much that you crash, that the bus goes off the road and crashes or something.
Right. It's not like a parade float.
Yeah.
It's not like that kind of showing off.
Yeah.
It's like it's still utilitarian.
Yeah.
And it's still going forward. But there's some showiness to it.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe your own drumming style?
Frenetic, kind of all over the place, maybe a little too fast.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely on the high end of like treble, you know what I mean? Like the sort
mm-hmm.
of this more timbali, Latin. The sounds of it aren't very deep. I don't have a lot of low end. It's all that sort of high, you know. My snare drum's tuned really high. My rack tom is tuned really high. Very sort of trebly. But Latin influence, still very punk rock.
Yeah. How much of that Latin influence comes from the couple of years of your childhood that you spent living in Brazil?
A lot. Because my first sort of, you know, first time I really saw drums was I was right at the right age in Brazil where I saw some, you know, for samba schools or samba parades.
Right.
So I'd see those surdos, like these big, you know, sort of almost like bass drums, but played like a upright, almost like a snare drum. And so that was like my first witness to all and to that kind of that style. And it always stayed with me. To this day, samba music really does affect me. And I know my sister feels the same way, just because we heard it at such a young age. And then I got into, like, rock and other stuff, and it wasn't until later, much, much later, like in my late 20s that I got into salsa music and Tita Puente and the people like that, and Celia Cruz and, you know. The mix of it that I used to hear would be like Bow Wow Wow.
Mm.
So I was into punk, but they had like such a, for lack of a better word, tribal feel with their drums.
Yeah.
That was the kind of really perfect marriage of everything for me.
Yeah, interesting. In 1988, you moved from New York to Chicago to be the drummer for a band called Trench Mouth, but you eventually quit that band. And then in 1988, you decided to go to South by Southwest and pose as a music journalist and film your interviews. Why did you decide to do that?
1998.
I thought that sounded wrong. Yeah, 1998.
Yeah, that's okay. I do that all the time.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And we can even say that 1998 is a celebration of 1988.
Yeah, it was the 10-year anniversary.
There you go. We were like, let's celebrate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
What made me want to do it? It was really frustration.
This seminar was called The Art of the Interview. It's this talk about how to give an interview and get the most out of your artist. I'm actually not sure exactly what she was talking about, but she seemed very focused about it.
Does anybody have any questions?
Yeah, from the other side of that, if you're interviewing someone and you want to get someone to loosen up a little bit, do you think it's proper or right to threaten them physically, say with a switchblade or a pistol or something?
That's an interesting approach, threatening with a switchblade. I'm not sure if that's the response you're looking for, though. You might just be seeing the back of them as they fly out the door.
I felt very frustrated by the music scene. I was in a band and I felt like we weren't getting very far. And for some reason, I just felt like, you know, South by Southwest is all about how to make it in the music biz. And I was very like, I think I was just, I had a chip on my shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, I'll make fun of it. I'll do a video where it's like making light of, you know, if anything, ambition and planning. It's almost like making fun of the idea of planning ahead. And the thing that I've discovered over the years is, for as much as I made fun of, you know, trying to go to a music festival to try to make it, it took me going to a music festival until I made it doing comedy.
Yeah. So how were you able to parlay the film into an audition for Saturday Night Live?
Well, it goes like this. It's like the video I would show at clubs around the country. You know, like I'd go to L.A.,
mm-hmm.
show it there, and people would come out. And all of a sudden, that was becoming like my act. I was just, instead of having a band, I would just go show this video. Then Bob Odenkirk saw that in L.A. at this club called Largo.
Yeah.
I mean, doing these different characters. Put me on a pilot for a sketch show he was doing called Next.
Right, for Fox Television.
Yeah.
Right,
put
yeah.
Put me on that. And then that didn't go. The show didn't go, but I had all this video of me doing all these characters sort of on a TV show. And then my manager at the time sent it to Marcy Klein at Saturday Night Live. She loved the tape and made Lorne Michaels watch it. And then they had me audition, and then I got the audition.
I just got my taxes done. Have you heard about these things, these taxes? Apparently. Mackie on drums, everybody.
During your time on SNL, you often portrayed drummer characters like Fedorcito and Mackie, a senile drummer. Do you see these characters as a way of maintaining your identity as a drummer?
Oh, definitely. I mean, for as much as I feel like, you know, I never got to make it as a drummer, I kind of did get to... By the way, make it is like a really weird term.
What I mean is
like to make a living from or like... I don't mean to, you know, separate what success looks like or anything like that. I just mean in terms of making a living at it.
Yeah.
And in a way, you know, when I was doing those sketches, I just felt like, well, here's my version of getting to, you know, make a living playing drums. You know, I don't consider myself that brilliant of a drummer where it could have been anything else. I know brilliant drummers, you know, like the guys in Tortoise and, you know, CN Cake and all those people, or Todd Trainer. Mm-hmm. So if I can't be that, but I could certainly do an impression of a type of drummer. Mm-hmm. So if I could do that, well, that's something. You know, maybe that's my way in. That's my way into the drummer's club.
Yeah, and it's turned out that it really has been, yeah. Since timing is such an important part of comedy, I'm curious about how being a drummer affects the rhythms and timings of your speech when you're portraying characters who are not musicians.
It's really very related in many ways, and ways that also I realized as I kept going, just in, like, even the rhythm of how long a song takes, mm-hmm. or in how long a sketch takes, going up in front of an audience and having a beginning of a song and the end of a song and talking about a song. It's so similar that I really, more than anything, my training, not just from drumming, but just from being in a band, mm-hmm. I think that was kind of, there was value to it. As much as I look back now and I sometimes think, boy, you know, we had a rough time, I think I did learn a lot about people's attention spans, being on a stage, I don't know, too much lighting, too little lighting, good sound quality. But, you know, stages that are too nice sometimes has an effect.
Yeah, you don't want them too nice.
You don't want them too nice.
No.
You need a little, got to have some, you know, life to it.
Yeah, some life, yeah. Some dirt, some, yeah, sure, some detritus,
like,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just something.
Yeah.
So all of that stuff put together is what, you know, I mean, I'm still learning, by the way. I'm not like, I haven't figured out how to do comedy. I mean, more like, it's just helping me learn what audiences, because it changes all the time, too, people's attention spans and expectations. And so, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I haven't figured out how to do radio. So,
yeah, that's good, though. I mean, that's good. Yeah, the way that you're thinking about it, about doing radio, I think is really healthy. And even though he might have been making like an understatement or an overstatement, I saw Paul McCartney once. He was saying that, I think he was like talking to a group of music students, and he was saying, like, I actually still don't know what I'm doing.
Really?
Yeah, and I'm probably,
wow,
I think I'm paraphrasing how he said it, but it was basically that he still approaches it like he's still trying to figure it out, which is really the best way to make art.
Absolutely, to continue to learn and experiment and try new things, yeah.
Yeah.
You carried your musical sensibility into your next big project, Portlandia, the sketch comedy series that you created with your fellow musician, Kerry Brownstein of Slater Kinney. And you had a lot of musicians on the show, like Eddie Vedder, The Flaming Lips, Amy Mann, and St. Vincent. Was that baked into the original concept of Portlandia, or did you and Kerry come up with it as the show evolved?
It was just inevitable. It's just what our world is anyway. Mm-hmm. So it was just such an easy, it really was the easiest route to take. It's something that we both know, and it's people that we both know. None of them were strangers to us. Steve Jones and Jeff Tweedy and all the people you mentioned.
Get over here. Do you see that?
Oh, it's our cleaning lady. That's great.
It's Amy Mann.
What? That's not Amy Mann.
Yes, it is.
Amy!
Amy!
It's so crazy. She's like in our house.
Why is she cleaning her house?
I mean, I guess the music industry must be really suffering or something. I don't know.
There's also a quality you get to a musician performing in that way that you don't get with comedians. You know, there's something a little weirder about it, which I liked.
Yeah.
You know, which was like, it was less rehearsed.
Yeah, more spontaneous, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I really like about Portlandia is the strong sense of place that the show has. It reminds me of SCTV, which, of course, took place in the town of Mellonville. Was SCTV an influence?
Yeah, SCTV is, like, an influence through almost everything I've done. Like, even at SNL, I remember I'd be talking to Bill Hader, and we were, like, some sketches were just straight up SCTV sketches. I was like, I just want to do something that I imagine they would do on SCTV. So that was kind of like the goal. And I think I'm always going to really idolize Rick Moranis.
Mm. Yeah.
His career, something about him, something about the way he was on the show. Like, I think I'm always just going to be like, man, that is the guy.
Yeah.
That's the one.
Yeah, and he's also, like you, he's not only a comedian and musician. He had that great album a few years ago. What was it, The Agoraphobic Cowboy?
Yeah.
Yeah. I know that you're a big fan of the band Devo. I am too. And one of my favorite Devo quotes is, choose your mutations carefully. So I'd like to ask you, do you think you have chosen your mutations carefully over the course of your life?
I think they chose me.
Yeah.
I think these mutations sort of, even the way that they've made themselves known to me was almost out of my control, which I kind of like.
How so?
There's like a real lesson in life of like, you know, you think you know the way that what you're supposed to do, and life knows better,
yeah.
Which is kind of great.
Yeah.
It's kind of great that like that's how surprising life is. It sort of taps you on the shoulder and says, you know, we're going to try this instead.
Yeah. Can you give me an example of a mutation that chose you?
I think my connection to Latin America, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that chose me.
Yeah.
As a little kid growing up, you want to be like everybody else. So I wanted to be Swedish or Italian, you know, whatever was around me. And it, you know, and I didn't want to learn this other language. My mom was teaching me Spanish. I want to speak English like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to assimilate. Well, this mutation was like, this is going to be a strength for you. This is going to like really open up your world. This is going to affect your drumming and how you see comedy and how you see language. So that's a mutation that kind of like picked me.
Yeah.
And failure as a mutation made itself known to me as like a something that could be an asset. So where I was like, oh my God, I'm never going to be the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I only want to be the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Please, God, please. And then this mutation is like, well, that's not what we have in store for you, but we've got something. What do you think of this?
Yeah.
And it's, to me, you know, much more fitting. I'm happy that Portlandia is a part of my life.
You got to be Fred Armisen.
I got to be Fred Armisen.
Fred Armisen is a comedian and a drummer. You can find out more about Fred on our website, wpr.org/beta.
These movies have a lot of common themes, and one of the really big themes is identity, this idea of who am I? Could I be someone else? Is there a way of changing my life?
Writer Brian Raftery tells us why so many great movies were released in 1999. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Can you come up with one year in cinema history that Hollywood really got it right? Maybe 1939, the year that The Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, and Stagecoach were released. Yeah, 1939 may have been a very good year for movies, but writer Brian Raftery argues that 1999 was even better. He makes the case in his book, Best Movie Year Ever, how 1999 blew up the big screen.
It's kind of a ridiculous list, and so much so that I actually had a friend who for a couple of years had a party trick where he would try to get people to name all of the hit movies of that year, and no one could ever get all of them. But the big ones really are, you can start with The Matrix, you have Fight Club, Sixth Sense, Blair Witch Project, Being John Malkovich, Election, and those are some of the big sort of critical hits. You also have Office Space, which was not a hit that year but became a big cult phenom.
Looks like you've been missing a lot of work lately.
I wouldn't say I've been missing it, Bob.
Good one.
Oh, that's terrific, Peter.
You have The Phantom Menace, which was not the greatest movie of 1999, but with the exception of Titanic, was absolutely the biggest movie of the 90s. And you also have all these interesting kind of subsets. Like, you know, Notting Hill is really one of the seminal romantic comedies of the 90s.
Yeah.
You have a bunch of teen movies like American Pie and She's All That and Varsity Blues that were huge hits in their own right. So it's a very varied year. I think I cover about 30 movies in the book,
mm-hmm.
and I had to cut at least 10 to 15, I think, that I really want to get into.
Yeah, yeah. You could easily do a sequel. A couple of sequels, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. What do you think was going on in Hollywood in the late 90s that allowed so many great movies to be released in this one year?
Some of it's circumstance. You know, obviously, movies take years to develop, and some of these films, like The Matrix or Boys Don't Cry, had been in the works, you know, throughout most of the mid-90s. So in some ways, it's a little bit of a coincidence, but I also think it was sort of a collision. I mean, if you look at the movies of that year, you have a lot of filmmakers, veteran filmmakers like Stanley Kubrick or George Lucas coming back after big stretches. You have a lot of filmmakers who had kind of made names for themselves in the 80s and 90s, like David Fincher and Michael Mann getting a chance to make movies. But you also had this remarkable crop of first-time filmmakers. And if you look at the list of first-time directors that year, you have Brad Bird making The Iron Giant. You have Spike Jonze making Being John Malkovich. You have Sofia Coppola making The Virgin Suicides, and on and on. So there was this generational kind of overlap, and it all happened in a period when Hollywood really needed some new ideas. The late 90s were really full of a lot of dying franchises. They were full of a lot of TV adaptations that didn't do well. So the studios, I think, recognized that there was a lot of excitement and momentum in the world of independent film, in the world of music videos, in the world of TV commercials, and pulled from all these different places. And all these people had a story they'd been wanting to tell for a long time.
Yeah, and as you say in your book, so many of these films were ahead of their time, and their themes are still relevant today. How did that happen?
You know, I thought about that a lot, about why, you know, these movies have a lot of common themes. And one of the really big themes is identity, this idea of, you know, who am I? Could I be someone else? Is there a way of changing my life?
The funny thing is I'm not pretending to be somebody else, and you are.
And that's a theme in almost all of these movies. I mean, it's you know, it's Cameron Diaz's character and Being John Malkovich. It's, you know, the guys in Office Space wanting to escape their life. It's Keanu Reeves in The Matrix and Edward Norton in Fight Club wanting to escape these sort of doldrums. And I think, you know, there's two big reasons for that. I think one is that this was just a slightly more navel-gazy time in America. I mean, this was pre-9/11, and the world felt a little more comfortable. And I think a lot of people were sort of stepping back and saying, okay, here's this thing coming up on the horizon. And that was the other thing, which was Y2K. And so there was this big deadline. And I think people, whether they could articulate it or realize at the time, I think Y2K and the new millennium was sort of this sort of subconscious deadline where it's like, we're really speeding into the future. Am I caught up? Am I who I need to be in this new world? And that idea, whether it was articulated or not, that sort of runs through these films, and it kind of gives them an electricity and a relevance that I think has kept them in the conversation, you know, 20 years later.
Yeah, for sure. As you say, storytelling was itself in the middle of a mutation. How did 1999 movies reinvent narratives?
I think, you know, one of the other directors who kind of made their name that year was Christopher Nolan, who in 1998 he'd put out this really cool black and white thriller called Following, and 1999 was the year he brought it to America. And that was a movie that I really recommend readers watch it if they haven't seen it. It's 70 minutes long. It's his first real movie. It's really crisp and smart, but it really plays with time, as a lot of movies did that year. Run Lola Run kind of broke up the narrative and pulled stories out of order. And I think, you know, Christopher Nolan's theory, and I think he's a guy who knows a lot about movie rhythms and structure. You know, his theory is that by the end of the 90s, you know, people had come to terms with movies being on video and being on DVD, and you could pause something and you could dive back in and rewatch. You could watch a movie out of order on DVD if you wanted to. So while a lot of films had clearly played with narrative structures, in 1999 you see these movies where a lot of narrative laws are being entirely, you know, either thrown away or rewritten. I mean, look at The Blair Witch Project. That's a movie that's, you know, shot by these actors in the middle of the woods. It's a movie with the setup is so minimal. You're just watching them and what they see through their camera.
I'm scared to close my eyes. I'm scared to open them.
A lot of big sort of story beats in that movie are just not explained because you just, after a decade of shows like Cops, people were so used to kind of the idea of found footage and someone mounting a camera on their shoulder and following them around. So there was a lot of really interesting experimental ideas and movies that went mainstream in a big way that year.
Yeah, and also the success of Quentin Tarantino's 1994 film Pulp Fiction, which really played with timelines, probably had something to do with it as well, right?
Oh, I think so. I think that movie loomed over a lot of the end of the 90s. People wanted, you know, and that's another reason why this year happened. Big studios wanted the next Pulp Fiction. They wanted a movie that had that momentum and that cultural currency, and you had to turn to new filmmakers to try to find something like that.
Look, I'm not paying you to do whatever it is you're doing out here.
Fine. So don't pay me.
Excuse me?
I quit.
so you don't have to pay me. Now leave me alone.
I think you just became my personal hero.
As you point out, a lot of the 1999 movies explored white-collar dissatisfaction. For example, mm-hmm. Office Space, American Beauty, and Fight Club. And Fight Club, I think, is one of the standout films from 1999. It's certainly one of my favorites, and I hope that you're okay with talking about it.
The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club.
Those listeners who haven't seen Fight Club, can you give us a brief synopsis of it?
Well, unfortunately, the first rule of Fight Club is that you can't talk about Fight Club. So,
break the rules.
I don't want to. It's weird. It's a 20-year-old movie. I don't want to ruin it for people, but you know what? It's 20 years old. So, and it's based on Chuck Palahniuk's book. And it's a very, you know, this movie came out in the fall of 1999. It was David Fincher, a remarkable filmmaker, given a huge budget. He's given these two huge stars. Edward Norton was a huge, you know. He was sort of seen as our generation's Dustin Hoffman at that point, this amazing, charismatic character actor. And you have Brad Pitt, and they're making a movie that either you think is very funny or you find deeply nihilist. Yeah. And it came out right after, just a few months after Columbine, and it's a very provocative film. It's a very disturbing movie, and I love it too, though interestingly, it's not, maybe not for the reasons it was made. I actually never kind of related to the movie's, you know, hang-ups on masculinity, but I really think it says a lot that this was a movie that was calling out consumer culture and our love of brands and the way we so willingly turn our lives over to these big products. You know, just a few years before we all started carrying iPhones and iPods in our pockets and started swearing our allegiance to big companies and their social media feeds. To me, that movie really captures just how much of the corporate, how much our corporate overlords were going to be kind of moving in on us in the 21st century.
Like so many others, I had become a slave to the IKEA nesting instinct.
Yes, I'd like to order the Erica Picari dust ruffles.
Please hold. I'd flip through catalogs and wonder, what kind of dining set defines me as a person? I had it all, even the glass dishes with tiny bubbles and imperfections, proof that they were crafted by the honest, simple, hardworking indigenous peoples of wherever.
I was holding.
Yeah, and it wasn't a box office hit, and it got a lot of criticism, didn't it? And a lot of critics responded really negatively to Fight Club.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I think some of them have changed their mind. I do think it's important to remember that this was a movie that was supposed to come out in the summer of 99. It got pushed back a few months because of Columbine, but I don't think that when it arrived that fall, I don't think Columbine was any less fresh in people's minds. And I think you can sort of look at the, you know, this was also only a couple years after Oklahoma City and the first World Trade Center bombing. And this was a movie about, you know, urban terrorism that was also having a lot of, was also disarmingly funny at times. And I think I remember seeing it on opening weekend and standing up at the end on a Friday night, seeing it in Manhattan Theater and turning to my friend and just being like, that was too much. Like, that was great. But I felt really pummeled by that movie in the same way that David Fincher's Seven really pummeled me, where I couldn't wash that movie off me, either one of these movies off me, for a couple of days afterward, which isn't what people go to the movies for sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of the movies released in 1999 explore identity and the desire that we have to be someone else, and these are ideas that are still a big part of our culture these days, maybe even more so these days. But what's your take on Spike Jonze's Being John Malkovich?
I love it. I mean, I remember, it's another movie that I remember very clearly, very vividly seeing and being really wowed by. And that movie, along with Three Kings, I know for sure that I took friends to see it the next week. I was like, you've got to see this movie. And, you know, for those who've forgotten the setup, it's, you know, John Cusack plays this very sad sack puppeteer who discovers behind a filing cabinet a portal that will allow you to enter John Malkovich's brain for 15 minutes. And he and his wife, who's played by Cameron Diaz, and Catherine Keener, who's this kind of opportunistic businesswoman, start charging people to go into John Malkovich's brain.
Mr. Malkovich, I think I can explain.
Yeah, explain.
My name is Craig Schwartz, and we operate a little business here that simulates for our clientele, well, the experience of being you, actually.
Simulate?
Yeah, after a fashion.
What exactly does that mean?
Well, it's hard to describe.
I want to do it, then.
I'm sure that would pale in comparison to the actual experience.
I want to do it!
It's an interesting movie in that, along with Boys Don't Cry, it talks a little bit about being transgender and is trying to address that in it way before that was something we were all talking about more frequently. But to me, that movie is sort of either a very early warning or a very stark prediction of what was going on with the internet. Because the whole movie is about how you can take over someone's identity and how easy and desirable that is. And to me, I feel like this whole idea of hijacking someone's identity and stealing their life, you can see a lot of that, what's played out now online every day in the early seeds of it and being John Malkovich.
Yeah, that's very true. Very good point. And you mentioned Three Kings. Talk a bit about that film.
That's absolutely – I keep saying these movies are my top five or top ten. That's absolutely – I think it's the most underrated movie of that year. It, for me, that movie was kind of my Matrix. When I saw that, I was just absolutely blown away by it. It was directed by David O. Russell, who has gone on to make a lot of movies like The Fighter. But this was after he had just made two really smart but very kind of outre indie comedies. And Warner Brothers said, what do you want to do? And they gave this young filmmaker, you know, excess of $50 million to go to the Arizona desert with George Clooney, who was then absolutely one of the biggest stars in the world because of ER.
Yeah.
And he makes this movie about these military guys who are in the Persian Gulf War. It's over, and they decide to try to steal some gold. And they slowly, over the course of some really remarkable action scenes, slowly start realizing the price of war and the roles they played in it. And it's funny. It's very jarring. It's a deeply – I mean, David O. Russell, he's one of the people I interviewed for the book.
Yeah.
And he was very much getting nervous about gun culture at that time in the late 90s. And he wrote it as sort of a meditation on gun violence.
The worst thing about a gunshot wound, provided that you survived the bullet, is something called sepsis.
Infection of the blood.
That's right. Say a bullet tears into your gut. Creates a cavity of dead tissue. That cavity, it fills up with bile, bacteria.
It's a shocking scene, and it was a shocking scene to watch, again, you know, right after Columbine. We'd had this massive loss of life from gun violence, and I think that movie is very prophetic, and it's also a movie that I don't think a studio would make anymore. It's just, it's very risky, it's very expensive, and there's too much to lose on a movie like Three Kings nowadays.
Besides Three Kings, is there another one that you would recommend to our listeners that, oh, you really should see this film?
Yes, everyone should see American Movie. Not American Beauty, which you can see if you want, but American Movie, which I did not have as much room for in the book as I would have liked, is a fantastic documentary about a Midwest filmmaker trying to make a low-budget horror movie.
You know, these are the vistas right here. And what does it feel like to have a couple rusty cars parked right against a rusty background? Because this is really fall and winter when the earth decays and the cars have decayed and these guys are decaying, you know? And that's what it's all about, rust and decay.
It's absolutely one of the best movies that year. It's very poignant, it's very smart, it's very funny. And I think it captures all of the excitement of 90s independent filmmaking in one two-hour movie. It's remarkable.
What were you like before all this? Were you like me, like a girl?
Yeah. Like a long time ago. And then I guess I was just like a boy. And I was just a jerk.
There were at least a couple of great films made by women released in 1999. Kimberly Pierce's Boys Don't Cry, which you mentioned earlier, and Sofia Coppola's The Virgin Suicides. And you talked to Allison Anders, another female filmmaker, and she co-wrote and co-directed Sugartown, which was released in 1999. Mm-hmm. What did she tell you about how 1999 was as a year for women filmmakers?
You know, she was very honest, and she said this was, you know, at that point, after the sort of 90s indie explosion, which was a lot more inclusive, I think, than Hollywood was. When you look at the movies that were winning at Sundance in the early 90s to mid-90s, there were a lot of female filmmakers, there were a lot of LGBTQ filmmakers, and I don't think those filmmakers got the same opportunities as women did. And she said, you know, this was great if you're a guy.
Yeah.
But the women were already kind of being written out of that history at that point. And I think it's true. And I think you can certainly see some really remarkable female filmmakers. I think, you know, the two female writers who wrote 10 Things I Hate About You, which is a really cool and absolutely beloved teen movie. There's a lot in Julia Stiles' character that's fantastic. And I think Run Lola Run, which has a female protagonist, is a remarkable movie, one of the best of that year. But certainly, it is the proportion of movies about men and women is way off, and the proportion of films written and directed and about people of color and LGBTQ members, filmmakers, is way off. And I think it's a question that we are asking a lot more in 2019 that we should have been asking in 1999.
And so we started to learn about their lives, coming to hold collective memories of times we hadn't experienced. We felt the imprisonment of being a girl, the way it made your mind active and dreamy, and how you ended up knowing what colors went together. We knew that the girls were really women in disguise, that they understood love and even death, and that our job was merely to create the noise that seemed to fascinate them. We knew that they knew everything about us, and that we couldn't fathom them at all.
You have this great quote from the actor, writer, and director Todd Field at the end of your book. Field told you that in 1999, we were passionate about seeing film as a way to enlarge our collective consciousness. Nowadays, it seems that we see film as a way to shrink our collective consciousness. What happened?
Well, I mean, it's very hard to look at it's very hard to understand sort of what's happened in the last 20 years to the film industry and to film going. I mean, because there are so many factors. Obviously, you know, in 1999, The Sopranos debuted, The West Wing debuted, Jon Stewart took over The Daily Show. There were a lot of monumental moments in television. And television soon started kind of taking over the culture and taking a lot of that cultural space. But I do think there's something shifting in why people go to the movies. Because in 2019, you don't necessarily have to go to the movies. You can watch things on Netflix. You can watch it on Amazon. You can wait 3 months until the latest movie is streaming. And so I think there's a little bit of a feeling that, well, I'm only going to go to the theater if I kind of know what I'm getting. And I understand that. You know, I mean, it's movie going is expensive, and the movie going experience is not always great for people who don't live near fancy theaters where they ask people to turn off their phones. You know, so you're asking people to pay a lot. And so you want to see a movie that you kind of already know what's going to happen. Whereas I think in 1999, I think a lot of filmmakers and the studios were really kind of interested in reflecting the world that was out there. And, you know, Steven Soderbergh also talks in the book a little bit about what 9/11 did to our desires from art. And, you know, and he points out that movies have always been a form of escapism. They're even more of a form of escapism now. And I do think we are still wrestling with how 9/11 changed what we want to see on screen. But certainly, if you look at 20 years ago, where these movies were really kind of grappled with real, real, real deep issues like identity and death and oppression and bigotry and a lot of interesting ideas, you know, a lot of the movies now are superheroes and zombie movies. They're movies about immortality, and they're not really quite... Some of them aren't looking quite as deep as to where we are. That said, there's a lot of franchise movies I love. I loved Black Panther. I love Blade Runner 2049. I love The Last Jedi, which some people find a very controversial opinion, I guess. But, you know, I get a lot of delight from big, ambitious, big-budget blockbuster movies. I just wish we could sneak in a few more Being John Malkovich's or Eyes Wide Shut's or Elections in there along the way.
Get more out of life. Go out to a movie.
Brian Raftery is the author of Best Movie Year Ever, How 1999 Blew Up the Big Screen. You can find out more about Brian on our website, wpr.org/beta. What are your favorite films from 1999? Or do you think that there was even a better year for film? Let us know by sending an email to beta@wpr.org. Or send us a tweet at WPRBeta.
I was so focused on making this cheesecake. And at that moment, I'd never done anything like that. I never have been as focused on anything. At that moment, I was like, this is what I need to be doing.
Top Chef contestant Kwame Onwuachi on the moment he decided to become a chef. That's coming up next. I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Once Kwame Onwuachi decided to become a professional chef, he didn't waste any time. Before he was 27 years old, Kwame had opened and closed one of the most talked-about restaurants in America. He had also launched his own catering company and appeared as a contestant on Bravo's Top Chef. He's captured all of this in his memoir, Notes from a Young Black Chef.
My love of cooking came from my mother, honestly. I started cooking kind of out of necessity. She had a catering business that she operated from the house, and me and my sister were her first two employees.
When you were 10 years old, your mother sent you to Nigeria to live with your paternal grandfather for the summer. Why?
Well, I was veering off on the wrong path, as that's easy to do growing up in the South Bronx, and she wanted to nip that in the bud and send me to a place where I would pretty much appreciate all the opportunities that I had here that I took for granted, even the small things like, you know, this cup of water that I'm drinking or the electricity. So that's the short answer of why she sent me to Nigeria.
Yeah, and also, as you write in the book, she wanted you to learn respect, right?
Absolutely.
Did you agree with her that you needed to learn that?
Not at the time, no. Of course not. I was a 10-year-old kid, you know, thought everything that I did was right.
Mm-hmm.
It taught me a lot, you know, and I think even when I came back, it wasn't instantaneous that I understood what I had been through. It was as I got older, I started to appreciate the things, the small things. That experience really started to develop me as a young man.
So what do you remember most about your time with your grandfather in Nigeria?
What I remember most about it is kind of the creativity that was sparked. You know, we didn't have electricity, so me and my cousins that were out there, we had to figure out how to recreate that environment that we were so used to back in America, you know, turning on the PlayStation or Dreamcast, which was out when I was there. We didn't have any of that, so we had to make up games, and that's what really kind of sparked my creativity, and that's what I remember a lot.
At the end of August, you called your mother to find out when you were coming home because you thought you were just going to be there for the summer, and then what did she tell you?
She told me I'm staying there until I learn respect. It was eye-opening. You know, I pretty much just dropped the phone and walked out of the call center in shambles and then, you know, spent the next 2 years in Nigeria learning respect.
Yeah. Did your grandfather say anything to you? Did he give you kind of any a life lesson in the form of words of wisdom just before you left after those 2 years to come back to the U.S.?
Yeah. He told me that I had connected with my home and my ancestors and, you know, I have a deeper understanding, and this will shape me as a man, having that connection to back home.
Yeah. Was there a moment, some kind of an epiphany that you experienced in your life when you realized that you wanted to be a professional chef?
Yeah, there was absolutely this epiphany moment. It happened in New York City. I was doing my first catering event. First of all, I wasn't even a caterer at the time, but I walked into a store in Soho, and this young lady was working the register. I thought she was just a clerk, and we struck up a conversation and find out she was the owner of the store. She was like, we just opened the store last week. I want to do a huge launch party for it. I'm looking for a caterer. She was just talking to me, and I was like, oh, you're looking for a caterer? I'm a caterer. You know, my mother had a catering company growing up, so I was like, you know, why don't I shoot my shot at this opportunity?
It's not such a stretch.
Exactly. So she was like, you're a caterer? How old are you? I was like, ma'am, this is irrelevant. Do you need a caterer or not? She's like, yeah, I need a caterer. I really want to have these like miniature cheesecakes, these mini strawberry cheesecakes. Can you do cheesecakes? Because that's like the only thing that I really want. Everything else is pretty much fair game. I was like, please don't disrespect me, okay? Like, I know how to cook. Totally bluffing. I never made a cheesecake in my life. So I had to go back home. So we agreed on doing a tasting the next morning. So I went back home and I started making cheesecakes all night long. And if you know anything about making a cheesecake, it's a long process. You have to make the batter, cook it, let it cool before you can understand what the true texture is. And that's like a 3-hour process. So first time, horrible. Second time, it was gritty. Third time, I like curdled the eggs. Now we're at, you know, about 9 hours. It's what, 7 a.m., 6 a.m. in the morning. You can start hearing the city coming alive. And at that moment, I was like, I looked at the kitchen. It was a mess, But I hadn't been on my phone this whole time. I hadn't stopped to talk to anybody.
Too busy.
I was so focused on making this cheesecake. And at that moment, I'd never done anything like that. I never have been as focused on anything. You know, I have ADHD. Like, at that moment, I was like, this is what I need to be doing. You know, this has calmed me.
Fast forward a few years, and you're attending the Culinary Institute of America.
Mm-hmm. My dream.
Yeah, and while you're attending there, you did an internship, or what CIA calls an externship, and you did this internship at Thomas Keller's restaurant Per Se, which was this huge deal, and still is this huge deal in New York City. And while you were working there, you experienced some abuse in the kitchen. Can you tell me what happened?
Unfortunately, it's what happens in the industry. You go to these extern sites or internships, and you're rode really, really hard. Some places harder than others. It's the old saying of, you know, that's kind of like where you cut your teeth in the industry. So the intricacies of that you can pick out in the book. There was definitely some times that it was of what I felt was some underlying racial tension, you know, from some of the cooks, some of the people that were in charge. And it's unfortunate because you're there for a passion. You know, you're there to give something your all. You're there to put your head down and just work. Having to feel that you're already not equal because you're at the bottom of the totem pole in the hierarchy, but then to add on another level of something that you can't control, you know, and that's something that I used to talk to myself about. I was born this way. I was born with this colored skin, you know. It's an unfortunate circumstance.
A TV producer once told you that you wouldn't make it on television because your cooking wasn't Southern enough. Can you tell me about this incident?
Yeah, so, you know, the television producer, I had to do a tasting for her in order to get on this show, essentially. And I did, I would say, a wildly refined 3-course lunch. And she told me my food was too refined and my skin was too dark. In order to do this type of cuisine, I would need to be white, essentially. And I don't think she was being malicious in her delivery. She was just a person that was in the business and giving it to me straight about what the audience was looking for at the time. And she also said, if I wanted to cook soul food, we can probably do this again. And that could be an avenue that we can try to go down. I was not going to compromise who I was in order to get a TV show at the time.
You didn't want to cook soul food because that wasn't really who you were.
No.
You did appear on television, though, as a contestant on the Bravo reality series Top Chef.
I'm really excited to compete in Last Chance Kitchen. I just want to get in there and get back in the game. I'm opening my restaurant soon, so winning Top Chef would really put my restaurant on the map and help me open up more restaurants around the country and even the world.
Hey, Kwame.
How you doing, Chef?
Good. Welcome to Last Chance Kitchen.
Thank you.
Can you tell me about your last elimination challenge?
Oh, yes. My last elimination challenge, we had to do a fast casual concept. I chose to do chicken and waffles. I used to do it a lot when I did catering. And I used Eggo waffles, or not Eggo, just like store-bought waffles instead of making my own. I couldn't procure a waffle iron, honestly, until halfway through the preparation. And by then, my mind was already made up. I was like super nervous. So I thought I could like toast them in butter and fry the chicken and season it really, really well. And that didn't really turn out well for me.
Kwame, your concept was very focused.
I was really focusing on giving you the standard chicken and waffle and just making it delicious and one bite, essentially.
Your dish had way too much technical precision and didn't feel like a fast casual dish.
Chicken and waffles, we've seen it. What excited me about your menu is seeing a sweet potato waffle and a coriander waffle. If you had made your own, then we would have had something really unique.
It's very difficult to send somebody home who cooks at the caliber that both of you do, but that is the nature of the competition. Kwame, please pack your knives and go.
You and your friend Greg were able to open your dream restaurant in D.C. a couple years ago, Shaw Bijou. What I found very intriguing was you wanted to tell your life story through the food that you served there. So can you tell me how you translated the story of your life to the food you served at Shaw Bijou?
I told into probably like an anecdotal tale throughout 18 courses, essentially. So, you know, the first course was like about my grandmother who's Jamaican, you know, and it was like jerk duck prosciutto with like chicken liver pate, spiced like andouille, and a couple other things. So that was like the cheese and charcuterie board. And then, you know, you come into the kitchen and there's chicken and lamb over rice, which I ate in New York City all the time from the halal carts, you know, but instead we did like lamb sweetbread on a basmati rice chip glazed in chicken jus with like a white sesame emulsion and Kashmiri pepper puree. So like the hot sauce, white sauce. So it was like that, like little tales that surrounded my life, all put on a menu.
Kwame Onwuachi is the author of Notes from a Young Black Chef. You can find out more about Kwame at WPR.org/beta. Well, Beta's been eliminated for this week. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Production.
You don't sell the steak, you sell the sizzle.
Our technical and music director is Steve Gotcher.
Steven, please pack your knives and go.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Adam, please pack your knives and go.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Doug, please pack your knives and go.